All right, let's go ahead and get our Bibles open and turn to the book of Exodus in chapter 32. Before we get into the meat of our class tonight, if you would, bow your heads together with me in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time to reflect and to consider your word. Please help us to be patient. Help us to allow ourselves the time that we need to mature and to grow, to not lose sight of heaven. Help us to be patient with those who are maturing in their own faith. Give us the wisdom that we need to know how to best engage them in your service. Please help us tonight specifically as we study through one of the periods of rebellion for the people of Israel. Help us to understand our own faith in the sight of theirs and draw closer to you through that growth. Please forgive us of our sins, and we offer this prayer in the name of your Son. Amen. All right, so we are in the 32nd chapter of the text of Exodus. There's not much left in Exodus on the page side, of number of pages that way. But there is a lot that's packed into these segments of the record. Exodus is part of the first five books of the Old Testament, sometimes referred to technically due to its historical term, the Pentateuch. But really we're talking about a chunk of history that covers, using our standard non-painted timeline. I don't know about you, but you've probably been in Bible classes before where timelines live up on the wall. And you can kind of put those places. We've got a physical one here. We've got creation all the way over there. And so we're right about here. And we're covering all the key concepts of life, of worship, of success, and of failure of a people. Sometimes highlighted on one person. But a lot of this story is about the story of God working with these people. In it, there are some sections that for various reasons we are more familiar with. If you were to go out and survey people who claimed to be believers and claimed a connection to the Bible, and you could say, tell me about the golden calf, except for those who ever show up to Jay Leno's TV show, because those I think are the exception. Most of the folks come back and maybe tell you a little bit about the story. And they might get some of it right. I think some of it they may not remember well. But if we're fair and we look at our mirrors where we see ourselves, we probably forget a few details too. To be fair about it, the details sometimes get lost because we connect to a part of the story. We connect either because we see ourselves in it, or we project others into that story and we say, well, this circumstance is just like when so-and-so did such and such. And so we're projecting another person's experience into the Bible, and then we remember it more because maybe it was a great day for us, or maybe it was a bad day for us, or maybe it was a great day for them, or it was a bad day for them. That's an instance that happens a lot with this story. This story is so recognizable, and this event has so much connection to who Israel was, is, and will be, that trying to look at it with fresh eyes is a bit of a challenge. And that's what I want us to try to do. That's why all that introduction is there. I try to see some of these events like we've been looking at Israel up to this point. A people who do not have a long heritage of worshiping God as a people. You remember, the family that goes into captivity is relatively tight-knit and small. We know it's tight-knit because they bicker. And the only way you bicker is if there's friction between two people. And the only way to have friction is to be close. It's kind of hard to have friction if you're 2 miles apart, 5 miles apart, or 10 miles apart. You might go to war, but you're not going to bicker. And the family that goes into Egypt bickers. Well, by the time we get to them leaving Egypt, They're not a tight little family, are they? They're a nation. They're still bickering a little bit, but there's also friction. There is conflict of an interpersonal nature, person to person. But think about this. Until Moses, and until his involvement with Israel, they don't have a heritage of worshiping Jehovah as a nation in a congregational sense. They have a family sense. They have an individual sense. They have a patriarchal sense. But all that's changing for them. So here in chapter 32, remember that while, they've certainly engaged themselves in this process, building the tabernacle, and they're gathering an understanding of what it's like to worship God in that way. Each step on this journey is a journey where somebody, maybe in leadership, maybe in service, is doing something for the first time. And the easy illustration is, remember the first time you did anything. How many of us were perfect at it day one? You may have thought you were, but you weren't. Because you just didn't know. You didn't know any better. You didn't know that you could have done it this way. You didn't know that this was available. You didn't know that this might work this way. And so you got better at it. Well, Israel has that opportunity here. They don't really make the best of it sometimes, which is probably a separate issue. But it does maybe help us reframe our first look into it. Let's start by reading verses 1 through 6 of chapter 32 to begin with. And Brian, could you read that for us? Exodus 32, verses 1 through 6. That last clause has a poignancy or a power to it in verse 6. My translation says, "And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." And everyone's visualization of the event probably comes in. You know, they've fashioned their object of worship. They've done so seemingly out of thin air. There's this big shift. Because they were just, the chapter closes out with them having standards and statutes about what worship would be. Deuteronomy 9 and verse 9 tells us that in the time frame that's advancing before this, Moses is gone for 40 days and 40 nights. So keep that in the back of your mind. There's a time frame. So it's not like out of clear blue. Keep that in mind, that there's some space there. 40 days and 40 nights is a long time. And you think about, for those who are married or who are with family and in their homes, can you picture a period of time where you have been separated for 40 days and 40 nights straight? Brian can go, yes. Is that a long time? It's a long time. Especially because it is uncomfortable. You've become accustomed to things being a certain way. And now they're not. And all the little things that don't seem to matter all of a sudden matter. Because they're not exactly right. In the leadership realm, in the worship realm, everything Israel is doing is new. They're learning, they're going. And by the way, Aaron's involved in a lot of that. Aaron has a role in worship of Jehovah, doesn't he? Yeah. God has assigned him that role. So when you think about all Israel here and their request, part of it is, to some degree, an understandable question. Where's Moses? Faith would have them wait longer. But have you ever waited 40 days for something? You get excited. Is it today? So that is, I understand the motivation. I think we probably all can. Secondly, Moses has been involved and Aaron has been involved and the leaders of Israel have been involved in structuring their worship up to this point. With Moses being gone, who is their point of contact to Jehovah, they want to connect to their Creator. They want to connect to their protector. But they also bring a baggage with them. Baggage is both the spiritual legacy that they had while they were in Egypt and all the idolatry that was with them. And remember, when they left Egypt, it wasn't just Israel. There are some hangers-on from the nations that were also in captivity that came with them. All of those nations did not have a heritage of even individual worship of Jehovah. They had their false gods, they had their idolatry, and so part of this motivation can be brought in from that side of the picture. They had idolatry in their camp, and it would have been an easy access. Hey, they're still worshiping over there, why can't we worship? But notice, who's been providing for them all this time? Jehovah had. And He still has. And even after the awfulness of this experience, He still will. Even after all of this plays out, God will still provide for them. In spite of how man might have responded to this action. This is a powerful point for us to see that God's responses don't always match ours. Because if you put yourself into God's shoes, and Israel is your household, and you come back, and your house has been turned into a den of idol worship, how would you respond? Well, think about it. You go out of town, and your kids hold a party at your house, and it's all torn up when you get back home. It's a classic thing that parents fear their kids are going to do, even when they have good kids. They're totally afraid of that happening, but they don't generally do that. That's the metaphor, if you will, to understand this. In their perspective, they're seeing Moses as not back at the time they thought he would come. I think that's another good point for us to consider, especially in understanding our trust and our faith. Most difficulties involving relationships fall into this space between that you could call unfulfilled expectations. Whether it's economic, spiritual, emotional, physical, doesn't really matter. So you build up this expectation of this is how it's going to be, but the reality is over here, and what you get frustrated about is this middle space right here. So Israel had this expectation that Moses would be back. God had a use for Moses that had him here. The frustration came in that difference of understanding. Faith should help us to trust to get to there. Faith in the person, faith in God, faith in a bigger plan. But that gap space is where you see this delay manifest itself with a request and a moving forward. And so they gather themselves together and they approach Aaron with a plan. Make us a God which shall go before us. And their reason is, we don't know what's happened to Moses. If you go back and you inch forward, and we've mentioned this a couple different times, when Moses is first introduced to us as an adult, after being raised in Pharaoh's household, what do the Israelites say about him? Actually, the Israelites, are you going to judge us? And then the time goes on, and he actually effectively is their judge. But now, how do they see him? He's like basically God to them. Yeah, I mean, if you think about when he comes down from the mountain and the face is glowing, does that make him different than everybody else? Yeah. So, I mean, there's a whole bunch of understandable bits and pieces to make us kind of be able to walk hand in hand with Israel. The reason we have to do that is because if we understand their choices, we can better understand our choices. If we understand their reasoning, we can better understand ours. And the goal is should build us a good sense of hope and then better choices. Because we're going to be in the same position that they are at times in our life. So in that sense, they want a God that goes before them. But what has God been doing so far? What's the evidence they have about Jehovah? Independent of Moses, by the way. Clouds and the fire. Manna. You know, water. Moses is involved in the Red Sea. You know, they see him there. But God's involved in all of these steps. And Moses has been clear that God does these things. Do we sometimes struggle to listen when people are telling us stuff? Yeah. Just like Israel. We have a lot in common, even though we don't want to be in common with parts of their choices and their actions. And, you know, it's only about in about 40 plus days. If you go back to Exodus 24 and verse 3. All the words which God, which Jehovah, hath spoken, we will do, was their signing on the line. Did God tell them to build a golden calf? No. Yeah. He gave them actual specific design plans. And in part of His commandments, was there anything about idol worship? Any like hint at it? Maybe it's not a good idea? Like really specific, like, don't do that. Like it was like Captain Obvious put on his uniform that day and said, this is a thing we don't do. Now, make a quick correlation because the application of this side of this text is pretty easy. In the New Testament, does it tell you and I as people in the kingdom, I'm not talking about people in the world, but you and I in the kingdom, that there are some things we should not, must not do? Like just absolutely not questions. These are not like you have to understand it maybe a little bit to make the application. But yeah, they're all right. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't murder. Do not commit adultery. I mean, we could probably make a nice list, right? Do you know Christians who have known that fact, known that detail, and yet ignored it and did what they wanted? Yeah, I think we all have. So again, we can kind of connect that simple application where this is not an ignorance issue. There's something else going on here. It's not that they don't know. So let me ask a question for you. What motivated their actions? What can you connect together as why now? Why not a week before? Why not 2 weeks from now? Why is it right now? Bobby? I mean, there's no doubt he's involved. He's involved in the very broadest sense that, and you can use it even connecting it back to the first instance of the serpent. Yeah, God said, but. Yeah, I know that's what he said, but. And the but comes into, yeah, you'll be like gods. You'll know, you'll be like him when God said no. I know God said no, but.
Oh, they don't have a leader.
Yeah. I think that's a huge factor. Leadership is massive in life. And it doesn't even have to be noticeable leadership. The sense of leadership, the idea of leadership, often enables us to make good choices, even if the person who's in charge maybe doesn't have it all together like we think they do. You know, if you really want to have your perspectives changed, try to read more about some of our founding presidents than just what's on the surface level. They were complex people. We hear some stories about some good choices they made, and they were awesome. They also did some bad things. That's pretty much every president who's served. You know, it doesn't matter where they come from on the spectrum of history and life. Same thing with Moses, David, Saul. Saul had a period of being a good king. You know, we can go down the line of all the kings. You know, and here's Aaron. And that's a great connection. Is Aaron a leader? Absolutely. Does he have times where he is a fabulous leader in his role? Yeah, he does. Well, it's not today. You know, and today is not that day. And we can see it. And in retrospect, I'm sure he could see it. But leaders get desperate too. When we first meet Moses and Aaron, Aaron is perceived by Moses as being the confident one, being the strong one. He's the one who should speak for me. He's the one who should go before Pharaoh. He's the big guy. I mean, you know, but is that actually how it plays out? Very quickly, the roles are turned right over. And God is using Moses as he intended to use Moses. And Aaron still has his place. Now Moses is not there. And Aaron's leadership style changes. He waffles. He acquiesces. He says, okay, we can do this. Even though we just said we're going to do exactly what God said. Bring me all the gold. We'll just take care of it. We'll just walk through it. A parallel passage to keep in mind that balances Exodus 24:3 is this statement that comes from 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 7. We as who are Christians should learn to walk by faith and not by sight. Even though Moses is not there, God's word still was. Even though some of the leadership of Israel was distracted or engaged in other tasks, God's standard was still there. They had all that they needed to be involved in at their hand. But as men often do, they lost sight of it, and we lose sight of it as well. Next section of the text, as it moves forward, we're going to pick up and just catch a few more verses in chapter 32. Let's pause for a second. Let's go and dig into a few more details before we do that. We're going to look at verses 7 through 11 in a moment. Aaron, I want to point this out, and this is identified all the way back in chapter 24 and verse 9. We talk about Moses' presence in the Lord's proximity. 24 verse 9, Aaron was close to the Lord too. He had that same connection. And that also helps us understand maybe a little bit more of the struggle that's going on there. He has a connection to Jehovah. But the only connection he has is connected also through Moses too. Because Moses is Aaron's link to a certain degree to Elohim, to Jehovah. He's got that same struggle that Israel does. But he's been a whole lot closer than the rest of the tribes. You know, he's gotten a lot closer to that. And in that section, and I think it's around verse 3 or 4, he makes a connection that this golden calf isn't going to be to a false god. It's going to be false worship to a true god. This is a feast unto Jehovah. That's an important distinction to make. Even though all the presence of idolatry is there, they're not abandoning Jehovah. What they're abandoning is the way in which Jehovah wants worship to be. And they're engaging in which everyone else does. They're saying, well, this is how everyone else worships. Let's worship that way too. Let's take a couple of seconds and talk about that real quick. Is that a common challenge for Christians today? If you see people in the world worshiping God as they see fit, do we sometimes wonder, why don't we do it that way too? Think about it this way. Do we get frustrated when the church doesn't build numbers the way we want it to? I'll raise my hand for that. I do. I want more people in Christ every day, period. And I get frustrated when I don't see results on a tangible level because I'm a human. I can only see to the end of my nose some days. And so I drive by like you guys do, and I see these groups, and they're 20 people, 30 people, 50 people, 100 people, 200 people, 500 people, 1,000. And I go, what's going on over there? And so I check it out. I'm curious. Oh, they got the new coffee maker in. Okay. Literally, that's how some of the groups grow. When you talk about some of the fastest growing mega churches of the last 20 years, they are commodity groups. They survey their neighborhoods. They ask what their pressing needs are. And you know what they do? They offer the answers to them. Now, the fastest growing church in Southern California grew by offering two things. You guys curious to know what they offered? I was too. They found out that they had a group of an area that said, we wish they had really good coffee. And they had a lot of young families, and so they wanted potty training classes. And so they hired a psychologist to teach potty training classes. And they brought in a Starbucks quality coffee place into the services. And you know what? People came for that because, you know what? It was free. Do you realize that works? If you want those things and someone offers to it, you'll go to it for free, right? But did they offer what God asked for? Oh. I mean, is good coffee good? Yeah. And there was a time in my life where I desperately wanted to be better at potty training. You know, and just the faster I can get through that phase of life was great. But that's what you see going on. There was a great desire. They offered it, and they grew. And their theory was they'll hear. The only thing is that group now has to constantly offer new things. What's the new thing? Because now everyone's potty trained their kids. And everyone's got their coffee satisfied, but now they want more. This is the illustration of that. All that's offered unto Jehovah. It says all offered unto Christ. The potty training, the coffee class, you know, the coffee stuff. This golden calf. What's the Jehovah? And it's the best golden calf in the land. I mean, you can see it from far off. I'm sure you could. If you think about it, a golden calf. What would the sun do that at the sunrise? Oh, that was pretty. It'll draw them in. But it was what they willed it to be rather than what God willed it to be. And that's a great kind of a simple illustration to connect part of the process of this event. Yeah, trying to be discreet with terminology is accurate there, that there's a high level of awful worship taking place. The various Canaanite gods fall into a couple of categories. There's fertility gods, and then there's war-based gods, just to think about them in that sense. And they're referred to by a couple of different terms. We often will say Baal or Baal to describe them. In Hebrew and Aramaic, it was Baal is a more guttural term for it. Whether or not it was on the warring side or the fertility side. Another group of that same gods that comes up later of the same Canaanite region is Molech. And if you remember, Molech is the one who demanded child sacrifice. And Israel said, sounds good to me. And they jumped right in. So the worship that they're engaging in is drawing from the practices of the nations around them. But now they're saying, well, it's to Jehovah. We're just to Jehovah. And so when they rise up to play, when they engage in that activity, you know, it's a very conflicting sense. It's easier for us to look at it and go, yeah, but what they're doing isn't outwardly immoral. Is good coffee immoral? No. Is potty training immoral? I hope not. Is doing it better than he did before? No, because it doesn't seem on the same scale. But understand this. On the sense of what God asked for, it doesn't matter if it was coffee or potty training or the worship of the Canaanites or child sacrifice, because that's not what God asked for. One of them compounds sin. It takes a little bit of sin, and then adds a lot, another layer of sin, and another layer of sin. But all sin severs from God equally. And so what we see taking place there is no different than if we did it today. If we chose to institute the world's worship plan and say, yeah, but it's to God, and so it makes it okay. That's a good thing to chew on if you want to have a long day of suffering when you think about your motivation for worship and your intentions for the choices that we make. All right, picking up here, we're actually going to read all the way down to verse 14 as a whole ensemble, but we're going to start with verses 7 through 8. And let me read that for us. Chapter 32, beginning in verse 7. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down for your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed it to it and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.'" It's as if the neighbors called and said, "Your kids are having a party. Get down and solve it." The scale just went to like maximum level, you know, as bad as it can be. How do you think you would feel in Moses' shoes? Yeah, I mean, on the first level, Moses is in this close connection to Jehovah, working as God designed to establish the standards of worship and whatever's taking place in that conversation and in that place. And the call comes, "You got to go down and fix your own house. It's out of order. The people that you are leading." My heart would sink, just drop to the bottom. But when we read it, don't read God's comments with a sense of, "Moses, you did this. Moses, this is your fault. This is, Moses, we've got to go save them." Change the tone a little bit. There's an emergency here. There's spiritual lives at stake. We've got to go save what we can save. And so read the tone of God's voice a little bit more in the sound of the ring at the fire station. And everyone is rushing to save who can be saved. Because both of them are there. There is a sense of condemnation. There is a sense of rebellion that God is identifying in His words to Moses. But Moses isn't the one who has done anything wrong. He's exactly where God asked him to be, doing exactly what God asked him to do to the best of his capacity. But now he has to go do something else. He's got to go be involved in this next step. And his leadership is crucial. We've talked about leadership in its vacuum, in its absence. Now it's going to be in his presence. And there's a few more details that come into play there. Before we get into the dissection of the text, though, does anyone have any quick comments? Tim, did you have something there? It rises, you know. That's why I said there's both tenors to it. Because we know from knowing God in the bigger sense of the Bible how God feels about spiritual adultery. I mean, that's as bad as it gets. "You have chased after foreign gods and left me. You have played the harlot, Israel." I mean, we know that about Him. But again, the direction is not at Moses. The direction is toward the sins of the people and whatever is entailed in there. And so that hotness, that fieriness, isn't directed at the feet of Moses or the heart of Moses. It's at the actual root of the problem. Now, is there a potential that Moses has part of the problem? Yeah, depends on what happened next. "Oh God, don't worry about that. They're just kids being kids." That's how some people play with sin. It's like wild oats. I got this. They'll grow out of it. Yeah. You know, oh, it's not a big deal. What's the big deal? They worship, and this gives us details that aren't necessarily included in the first part of it. According to the report that comes through Jehovah, they worshiped the golden calf. They sacrificed to the calf. They called it their God. And they accredited their rescue from Egypt to the thing that they had made. If you make notes in your Bible, if they're not already there, just connect it right to Romans. That's exactly what Paul deals with when writing to the Roman brethren about those who would make their own gods. They make them in their own image and they bow down to them. Look, here's our God. He looks just like us. Isn't he great? There may be some analogies to why they chose a cow for their deity at that point, but that's for a later study. Verses 9 and 10 of chapter 32. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you. Now, Tim talked about how hot it's going to get. He went from sitting at the stoplight, pedal to the metal. Let's just clean the slate. Like in the space of the intersection, he's at top speed. I am going to erase them. I'm going to consume all of them, and Moses will make a nation out of you. So again, we talked about the comparison of how light it seems at times the difference is in worship today versus this one right here. Remember how God's response is to it. It's not just, hey, go fix it. It's, we'll just take them off the table altogether. We'll start fresh and clean. Wipe the slate. So you can see that rising of his attitude as the story opens up. And again, like I pointed out, it's not towards Moses. Because Moses is the one who he's going to use as the seed for a new people. Now, you're in Moses' shoes. How do you feel about God talking to you in that way? This is a conversation, by the way. He's telling you, it's basically you have an opportunity to talk back. Do you stick up for these people? Bobby? Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like when parents talk about a kid, that's your child. That's all you right there. That's not me. That's all you. It's not actually that way. It never works that way. But think about, I can see a second, Tim. In the people of Israel, as they worked with Moses, at times they wore him out. If God had asked Moses that question on a couple of days in the past, do you think Moses' answer might end up being a little different? When they were wearing him down with question after question after question. When they were stubborn towards Moses. Or when he was fleeing from them. So you think about it in the familial sense, in the way in which a relationship goes on, because there's a lot of that there. When we're frustrated, we're easy to give up, but Moses doesn't do that. Moses has failings as leader for sure. Aaron does too. But he doesn't quit on them. He doesn't quit on Israel. God doesn't want to quit on them either in the bigger sense. It's a very passionate conversation here, but he's very patient. Tim? Something to understand, if you plead for someone to receive mercy, you extend a portion of yourself in that plea. You're asking someone to be merciful. Understand this, when you do that, when you make that request, the person you're asking will look at you differently. Well, how can they show compassion for that person? This person did this. Why should I forgive them? Why should I let them go? But they did all these things. Shouldn't there be a punishment? And yet, mercy is on the table. And we're going to have to read about that next class because we've only got 2 minutes left. Moses is willing to do that. The people of God are always people who have been willing to do that. Most often, they plead for mercy for those other than themselves. A lot of the requests for mercy outside of the Psalms, even though there are some in the Psalms too, are mercy on behalf of the people. Mercy on behalf of a person. And sometimes, yeah, mercy for them. Like with David and a few other instances too. J.W.? Yeah, I would say on a personal level, I would probably feel similarly in some ways, but on the textual level, it doesn't give us enough information one way or the other on that side of things. But there's no doubt that he wants him to be involved because the first statement is, you need to go down there. You need to go help this. And then he gives them additional information to explain his emotions, to explain the reasoning. But as again, it says, I think the King James uses the phrase, his wrath waxed hot, as opposed to waxing cold. And so that's why you see that rise of temperature in his terminology and the rise in consequences from go fix it to let's wipe it clean. Because that's like two verses apart, right? Go down there. No, let's just wipe it clean. You think about the shock and revelation that people go through when they see something awful take place around them, or maybe something awful happens to them. It's very similar to that same process where it's shock, what's going on? Anger, why did this happen? It's a very normal procedure on the human side, which our emotional base comes from God's. That's it for our time tonight, so we'll pick up in verse 10 and 11 of chapter 32. On Sunday morning. Thanks, everybody.